This is KAB, Antonio Bay, California. 6 minutes after midnight. Haven't heard from the weatherman yet, so I can't say for sure about that rain. But there's a full moon and no clouds in the sky. I'm Stevie Wayne, and if you don't have anything to do right now, I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I saw the fog last night.
Hello once again to an episode of the IMMP podcast from the Intermillennium Media Project. My name is Matthew Porter.
And I'm Ian Porter.
I'm his dad, he's my son, and I've made him watch a movie this time. Back to movies after a few weeks of television.
To cinema.
I tried to raise you with a varied cultural diet. So it wasn't just 60s and 70s TV. Sometimes it was 70s and 80s movies.
Exactly. And this is one that I should have seen coming, but I don't think I was awake for the list of potentials because we are returning to something that has had odd effects on me already.
Yes, we have returned to an auteur we have seen before, John Carpenter.
John Carpenter.
And an auteur who you find to be an effective sleep aid.
Yes, every single time we do John Carpenter films, they knock me unconscious. Not because they are not interesting, not because they are boring, but because John Carpenter makes his soundtracks.
Yes.
John Carpenter likes his rhythmic synth soundtracks that add this spooky, ethereal nature. And for some reason, they just lull me to sleep every time.
Yes, indeed. You're one of the few people I know who found Escape from New York so soothing, so sleep-inducing.
Yes.
But you're right, it's that soundtrack.
It's that soundtrack every time. But when you told me we had another John Carpenter thing, I was prepared.
Yes.
I sat there. It was late, but I sat there on a night I was specifically having a hard time sleeping with an energy drink in hand to get through this.
Well, in the past, we have looked at, we watched Escape from New York as one of our Patreon bonuses. We both watched for the first time Escape from L.A. I don't know that we've done any other John Carpenter for the podcast.
Didn't we do The Thing?
Oh, of course, of course, of course. The Thing. That was one of our snowy January episodes a few years ago.
And the ironic thing is, there's one movie of his I love.
Oh, what's that?
That doesn't put me to sleep. It's my favorite movie of all time.
Oh, let me guess. No, I don't want to guess. What is it?
Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh, of course, yes. We haven't looked at that. We might at some
point. We haven't looked at that yet, but... Yeah. That was another John Carpenter directed. It's the one that doesn't do that to me.
No, I don't know if he did. Did he do the soundtrack for that? He probably did. But maybe
I'm
he was
not
just
sure.
Getting more varied by that time.
He worked with Alan Howarth on that one. So it might be Alan's effects helping.
And I don't know that we've mentioned the title of the movie we're talking about today yet.
I don't think so.
It is The Fog from
The Fog.
1980. And on this soundtrack, he collaborated with Dan Wyman, who had also collaborated with him on the Halloween soundtrack. And perhaps because of that, there are a lot of similarities between the soundtrack, the score, I should say, for Halloween and for The Fog. They both got that very moody, evocative, but somehow sharp piano in the lead.
It's iconic in some ways, the way this sounds. And this movie is, I'll say right now, it is a story that is big on suspense. I wouldn't say it has a lot of plot beats overall, but that's because it spends a good amount of time in each one of those.
Yes, yes. That's an interesting thing about the structure of this movie that I'm going to want to talk about. But you're right, it's not a typical plot-heavy horror movie. But one of the reasons we're doing this in April, you might think we would have saved this for October, but instead we're celebrating the anniversary of Antonio Bay, California.
Exactly.
Here in April. because that is the hook for the timing of this story.
Yeah, it's the Founder's Day.
Yeah, this coastal town in California, I gather Northern California, and it is the 100th anniversary of the founding of this town. And it turns out that the town has a dark secret that comes back to haunt them quite literally. And that yes. is what gives rise to the structure of this, because we're really getting, it's almost an anthology in that we're getting these different little glimpses, because what's happening is affecting the whole town. Mm-hmm. And we're getting little vignettes of how it's affecting certain people when we're cutting back and forth between and among different groups of people and how they are being affected by this overall event. It's almost like a story structure like Storm of the Century or something like that, where there's this giant event and it is sparking all these different stories.
Yes. And the interesting thing is that you'll gain as the audience a little bit about what's going on from one person, and then we'll cut to someone else who doesn't know they're in danger.
Yes.
And so you get to be there doing the classic, no, don't open the door, kind of scared horror movie thing, because you know that the thing on the other side is dangerous and they don't.
And tying all of this together is Adrian Barbeau as the local radio station owner and sole on-air personality. Mm-hmm. And she is at this lighthouse transmitter near the coast, so she can see what's happening with the fog, and we'll talk about that. And she can sort of try to get the word out to the people in town who can hear her on the radio. In some ways, she is our surrogate for some scenes in which she's the one saying, get out of there, run. What are you doing? This thing is coming to get you, just like we would be. And yet, and just as much as we are powerless to actually influence the character's actions, she can't hear them. She doesn't know if they're following her advice, and she has no control over what's happening. All she can do is put out these desperate pleas to do something.
Yeah, she cries out into the void and hopes that people hear her. That's all they have. And it's honestly, her through line is what makes this movie work for me.
Mm-hmm.
At all. The vignettes of horror and the characters who move from one to the other give it some through line elsewhere, but it's her in the radio tower cutting from thing to thing really helps.
And it shows what a strong presence Adrian Barbeau is in some of these kinds of movies. She was married to John Carpenter at the time this movie was made, and she has been very important in this and in Escape from New York and a number of his movies. Mm-hmm. And you're right. She adds this sort of she's the one who adds more of a structure to the movie than it would otherwise have. This is the first time that I've seen this movie in quite a long time. And there were things that I misremembered about it. I remembered it being more of a mystery. To the extent that I like horror movies, I tend to like horror movies with a strong component of mystery, where part of it of what's happening in the plot, there are horror events happening. But the plot is about uncovering the mystery and learning what has to be done to solve it, to solve the problem. And I remember this as being more of a mystery, but the critical piece of hidden information is actually revealed very early in the movie.
Yeah, surprisingly early.
It is. It kind of shocked me, like, whoa, I thought they learned this at the end, but no. Hal Holbrook plays the local priest. I gather he's an Episcopal priest because his grandfather was also a priest.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the movie, a piece of wall conveniently starts crumbling, and he finds within there the journal from his grandfather. And it reveals the dark secret about the founding of this town, in that there was a wealthy man who contracted leprosy, who wanted to relocate the nearest leper colony to a more hospitable place, to use his money to build a better place, a better habitat, a better facility for himself and the other people with leprosy. And and he had a lot of money, so that would not be a problem. He wanted the agreement and the blessing of the local community, which at the time it wasn't yet a town, so the local pastor was the main person to talk to. And the pastor was of two minds about this, because on one hand, he wanted to show Christian compassion. On the other hand, he didn't necessarily want a leper colony next door. And on the other hand, there was all this gold with which something other than a leper colony could be done. And this just devastates Hal Holbrook's character. And he, when bad things start to happen, he's the one who realizes, yeah, this is our punishment for what was done by our forefathers 100 years ago.
Yep. Because it is, in fact, the ghost of the lepers of the leper colony.
Yes. In my mind, shorthand for this movie tends to be stabby pirate ghosts. But they're not pirates. They are the victims of thieves. They are not, they're victims of piracy even. They are not, they were not pirates. They were the plot that the six founders of Antonio Bay concocted was during a foggy night when the ship that was hired by this wealthy leper was transporting his gold and his and the people and their belongings. They built a fire on the beach to lure them in to a place where the ship would be dashed against the rocks. And that killed everyone aboard. Yeah, fake light, fake false lighthouse. And then they just raided the wreck of the ship for all the gold and valuables. And that is what that wealth is what made it possible to found this nice thriving town of Antonio Bay. That's very dark.
It's very dark. It's very dark, and it's also very classic in some ways.
Yes.
In terms of like, this isn't a. It's a very, and not just because it's like a thing 100 years ago, but there's something about this like almost like the historical feeling of it has this classical tone, which means that it has this extra weight of realism to it.
Yeah.
The ghost aspect is a thinner layer on top of the awful people that have done awful things kind of feeling that like, oh my goodness. And we're getting this all from the descendant of one of these people reading the journal of one of the people who did this, and you can hear layers of guilt in all those descriptions.
Right.
Where all the descriptions of this leprous man, Blake, are kind and nice, and he sounds like a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear Father Malone's grandfather just hating himself for what they chose to do. And you also get to watch Father Malone grow disgusted and terrified at him, at his grandfather, at his own family legacy, at the town, which is interesting because it starts out with people like getting ready for this party and some people don't care, some people care. But the fact that over the time, as people figure this out, everyone just starts to hate this place.
Yes.
Because of what it now represents is so evocative.
Yeah, the writing in this journal, as we hear Hal Holbrook read it, it's almost as if we can watch his grandfather doing what he's doing. It's so evocative, and as he's doing it, he's saying, "I feel so guilty. I shouldn't be doing this. May God have mercy on this my soul for doing this." While he's doing it, he's claiming some kind of remorse. When at any moment he can decide, no, I'm not going to kill these people. No, I'm not going to crash their ship into the rocks. No, I'm not going to raid their corpses and the wreck of their ship. And yet he continues to do what he does while still wanting to maintain this illusion that I'm really a good person. This isn't like me. Well, it kind of is.
Oh, woe is me for the evils I have felt and done, as he loads his pockets full of gold.
It's like, right. And Holbrook recognizes his own guilt and the guilt of this town. And he has this sense of we are responsible for the sins of our forebears. And that's what this movie is about, as so many classical stories are. And after that, once we have that established, and we have that established within the first half of the movie in a few, like two or three chunks, because at some point Holbrook's character, Father Malone, explains all of this history to the chairperson of the anniversary celebration committee, who's supposed to let the mayor and others know about this. And also he's explaining why he's not going to go and offer the benedictive prayer at the festivities.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, a fog has begun rolling in at a certain time of night, starting just before this anniversary date.
It doesn't even roll in normally.
No.
It changes direction.
It does not follow the wind.
And that's the that's one of the first things where it's like, we're getting radio reports, we're getting boats damaged and aged, like they've been sunk underwater for years when the wreckage are found.
Yes.
And the radio station and the weather station are the two places that notice the most of what's going on here, because they're both up late at night, and they both have the instruments and the connections to see it early.
Yeah, that's a good point. As far as that structure, there is someone who Adrian Barbeau's character gets to talk with back and forth, and that is the meteorologist at the nearby weather station, where she gets the weather reports to put on the radio, but they talk on the phone, and they can have back and forth about what they're seeing, what they're discovering. So we get a little bit of interaction from her as well.
Mm-hmm. And she pays for those weather reports by continually having to reject his weather station guy's advances in a very awkward bit.
Yep. And they do establish at the very beginning that this is a town that likes its ghost stories. At the very beginning, the first scenes are John Houseman. I think this is the only scene we get John Houseman in. But he's telling a bunch of very little kids some scary stories around a campfire.
Yes.
And one of them is about this ship that crashed on the rocks 100 years ago. And some say that on some special nights between midnight and 1 a.m., these ghosts will come back when the fog wraps around Antonio Bay. The ghost story doesn't say anything about why they crashed on the rocks. We only learn that from the journal that Hal Holbrook finds. But at least they have this, they know there was this tragedy in the past. They just don't know about their own responsibility for it. And it's kind of an odd role for John Houseman, in that we're used to seeing him as, I'm used to seeing him as very, well, he's best known for the paper chase, a very stern professorial kind of role. And here he is as the old sea captain. They probably just said, hey, we got one day of filming for you. Put on this hat and tell this story. And it was fine. It worked great. It just seemed a little bit odd for John Houseman to be in that role to me.
Yeah.
But it was a good way of setting up where we were and what sort of tone this town had about its own history.
It also sets the tone of this is going to be a creepy story early enough, but it doesn't give the entire plot away too soon.
No, because then we really start to get into the different groups of people, and there is a little bit of a mystery investigation aspect to it, because two of the characters that we follow, one of them is another person known from other John Carpenter movies, Jamie Lee Curtis, most famous for Halloween.
Yes.
And she plays a person who's just hitchhiking from San Diego to Vancouver or Seattle. And she meets up with a local guy, and they hit it off.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Are you weird?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am weird.
You are weird.
Yes.
You're weird, thank God. The last ride I had was so normal, it was disgusting.
But he is concerned about his friend who was on a fishing trawler that was out the night before. And we know that the night before, the fog came in and unpleasant things happened between midnight and 1 a.m., which is the time when these ghosts can be active. And we see this fishing trawler be wrapped in this fog that doesn't follow the wind and is highly unnatural and glows. And they are attacked by the physical enough to chop you into pieces ghosts.
Tactile ghosts can always be a bit of an oddity.
Yeah. I mean, if they can hurt us, we should be able to hurt them, or vice versa.
Theoretically, yeah.
And I wasn't sure how you were going to feel about this movie, because this probably had a bit more violence than the movies we tend to watch for the podcast.
Honestly, I was surprised by how much violence was in there. It caught me off guard.
Yeah.
But it was also, none of the moments were without buildup.
Yes.
Everything made sense when it happened.
Right. And there was no sudden jump scare type violence. If you don't like watching the violence, they always gave you plenty of warning to cover your eyes. So I appreciate that in a horror movie. And the violence was not as graphic as in many other movies. It was always shot relatively dark, relatively shadowy. It was still horrific at times, but it wasn't reveling in the blood quite as much as some movies do. And you're right. It all fit the story. It was all sort of inevitable given what was established already.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that every bit made sense when it happened helped. Mm-hmm. It was more violent, but it also didn't revel in that in the same way.
Yeah.
When someone gets sliced, there is a graphic moment and a splurt of blood, but it doesn't sit and watch them.
Right.
And it's different.
Mm-hmm.
So
we see what happens to the crew of this trawler. And then later we see the friend of one of the people who was there, go to the Hulk, the abandoned trawler out at sea with Jamie Lee Curtis's character as well, and essentially find the results of this. And everything, the boat is wet with salt water as if it had been submerged for a time. And yet here mm-hmm. it is floating. They eventually find at least one body of one of the people who was cut up by the ghosts and bring him back to the medical examiner on shore. And the medical examiner says, I know you found him on the boat, but every indication is that he was like under the sea when he died.
Like, this man drowned. I have no answer as to how, but he did.
So it's this combination of, there are physical causes of death that we see, pirates with swords and spiky things. Or not, I keep saying pirates, nautical saying pirates. Ghosts with swords and spiky things. And on the other hand, the exact means of death are spooky and unnatural and are clearly supported by evidence, but not possible. So I kind of like that. And we do see on the trawler the effects of this fog coming in that it gets everything wet and frosty, and it is almost like the sea is reaching up to grab this ship. And briefly we see pulling alongside, floating, the wreck of this 100-year-old ship that was mm-hmm. Was transporting the residents of the leper colony. Very cool, very atmospheric. They don't overuse
very things. Atmospheric.
I don't know that we see the ship again, but I love the way
it
establishes.
I don't think we do. That's what I was trying to think. It's like, I know that we do, and I know that there's a piece of the ship that becomes a piece and a MacGuffin later for a moment.
Yes.
But I don't think we see the ship itself any time after that.
I don't think so. Adrienne Barbeau has a little boy. Her character has a little son who finds mm-hmm. on the shore he thinks it's a gold coin. When he goes to find it, it's actually a piece of wood. And the piece of wood is a broken part of a name plaque for a ship. And it appears to be from the ship that was transporting the leper colony.
Yeah. So it's just this piece of wood with Dane inscribed on it.
And she, in puzzling over this, she brings it to the radio studio, and it becomes the focus of a daylight haunting that she has to deal with, in that water starts creeping into the studio, and eventually the piece of wood catches fire, and as it does that, she looks at it, no longer says Dane, it says Six Must Die.
Yes.
And we learn from Hal Holbrook and the journal, there were six conspirators behind the plot to lure the ship to its destruction and raid the wealth for the sake of the new town. So they want six to be punished because six people did the bad thing.
And I want to lean in on this for a moment, a bit more. That moment is so well done because it also does I too love in a horror thing when it has rules. I don't just want something that is infinitely powerful. I want mm-hmm. something with rules and power beyond what our heroes know. And you can try to piece together how this works. It's a little bit of a horror through the lens of being a scientist in that sense,
yes.
where I want to be able to build a hypothesis as to how ghosts work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel the same way. That's how I like the mystery element. I want there to be pieces that fit together. I want there to be something learnable as opposed to there's no explanation for this.
Mm-hmm. But they do a good job, especially with how the slow buildup of this works, of establishing these little things that give you hints as to what you might be seeing. Because first we see this old piece of wood, and then it cuts to that while she's doing stuff, and it forms this little film on it.
Mm.
And then the film dissolves into water, which immediately evaporates into mist.
Yes.
Into fog.
Right.
And only when all of that goes away does it burst into flames and the text changes. And when the flames go out, it's done. But it very much feels like the ghosts are the fog.
Mm-hmm.
They are one in the same. And this right. is one of those moments that establishes the idea that, you know, they are the fog now. They are this storm. And so the bit of them, the bit of the ghosts trapped in that piece of wood is what let them do this, is what is how they made that message. But it shows, it's kind of yeah. like watching the bad guy, or the not the bad guy even, watching a character sneak into a place
mm-hmm.
when they keep cutting back to see this very physical transformation in the wood as the fog leaches out of it and into the room in order to gain control of the room and show a vision mm-hmm. before dissipating. It has a very tactile sense to their haunting in that nature.
And when you think about that, what led to their destruction? What tools were used in their murders? A bonfire and the fog.
Yes.
The weapons, per se, that were used to kill them, they have become one with those elements. And that they are now mm-hmm. they are now some of the tools that they are using to find and exact their revenge. So yeah, I like that the idea that they are and the fog are one. They are part of the fog, and we see that later.
Yeah, there's a bit of a live by the sword, die by the sword counterpoint here of be killed by the sword in a way that is unjust and deserving vengeance, haunt by the sword kind of way. It's like, oh yeah, you yeah. have picked the form of your destroyer. Understood.
And we see this happen across two nights because apparently the ghosts can only be active and have effect between midnight and 1 a.m., which is the hour during which they were killed 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So the night before the anniversary, we have these events happening between midnight and 1 a.m. The ship is attacked and the fog comes into land and it comes to the house where the guy that Jamie Lee Curtis is investigating this mystery with, and it's a great scene. They pound on his door. He gets out of bed and goes to the door. It is just about to open the door, and we know what's going to happen when he opens this door. And it strikes 1 a.m. and his clock yep. cracks, but the fog and the ghosts disappear. So he narrowly missed being the next victim of the ghosts. But that set yes. up this great tension that. People are in grave danger, but also the ghosts have limitations. They can only act within this hour. But we know the next day is the big celebration. So we know the ghosts are not done with their mission.
Yeah, and they've been getting, and they're a little bit more aggressive each day to some extent.
And we saw the six must die message briefly when the name plaque from the ship transformed. And when one of the victims from the boat from the fishing trawler that was attacked, when one of them is at the medical examiner, he gets up zombie-like and tries to attack someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And before he's put down, I guess, scrawls on the floor, three. So but that's just confirming for us viewers, three of the six people upon whom revenge must be taken have now been killed. So there are three more to be done the next night. And mm-hmm. the next night, it's as if the ghosts had less distance to travel. The fog was already nearby. We see the fog come in around midnight. And that's where we get the reports from Adrienne Barbeau on the radio, who can see the fog as she's looking down at the town and give reports about what streets it's at and where it is. And she is trying to warn her friend at the weather station because it's one of the first places enveloped and it doesn't go well for him.
Yeah. And we get the heart-wrenching moment where he's just, you know, oh yeah, oh, someone's at the door. Oh, they're shining their headlights through my window. I'll go deal with that. It's like, don't do it. Puts down his headphones. No, don't. And we're there yelling at him alongside Adrian's characters. Just no, don't.
It's a little bit of the same feel as some of the most tense scenes in Alien, where you've got the one person who's in danger and someone else who is in radio contact with the person in danger, or even Aliens, the sequel, where you've got the motion detectors and there is the one person who can see what's happening and someone else who's in danger that they're trying to communicate with. There's a wonderful tension you get there because it's limited communication back and forth. And there's someone who can see something terrible about to happen and not do much about it. And we get a bit more of that because the ghosts then attack the home of the nice lady who takes care of Adrian Barbeau's son when she's on the radio. I forget the old lady's name, but yeah, it doesn't go well for her. And no. A wonderful tense scene where after they get her, the ghosts are going after the kid who they want to make the next victim, but someone rescues him at just the last moment. So there are a lot of those kind of setup and high tension and last minute rescue kinds of things. But some of the best scenes are just Barbeau trying to warn people about where the fog is and where they should go.
And as she's kind of calling to each of these little vignettes, there's this group of people listening, becoming aware of the danger, starting to piece together some of the things they can do to prevent it, and running in to rescue, you know, her kid, things like that. And that's where we do build kind of a crew of people who, you know, gather pieces from the different vignettes for the final confrontation as they run around and save people, don't make it to other people in time, and congregate at the church in the end.
Right. So we've got Adrian Barbeau, who is eventually attacked by ghosts there at the lighthouse, but we've got Jamie Lee Curtis and Tom Atkins, who's playing Nick Castle, who is the guy she's been investigating with. Cool name, Nick Castle. Wonder if any relation to Rick Castle, I wonder.
I wonder.
Probably not. That was a pen name.
Probably.
And we've got Janet Leigh and Nancy Loomis as the chairperson of the anniversary celebrations and her assistant. And they're some of the people we see like driving around town trying to avoid the fog. And also, meanwhile, there is the anniversary celebration at the, I guess, the city fairgrounds. And that is full of like everybody in town all in one place susceptible to this fog when it comes in. So there is a lot of sense of who is going to be next and where is the fog going to go? Because again, it's not following the traditional meteorological rules of how fog moves. And and because it's at high ground and it's outside of town, Adrian Barbeau is on the radio advising anybody who can get out of town to gather at the old church where Hal Holbrook is the pastor.
Which does lead to the fun thing of everyone arriving there and him being like, why? Of course they're going to come here. Right. I have a book here saying that we're all to blame and they've got every right to come here and kick my butt.
We're all doomed, me more than most. I guess you're here to watch it or take
exactly.
part. Because he...
oh my God. That little moment where everyone's spirits just like skip like a warped record for a moment as they arrive and that's the priest's response is brilliant.
Because from the moment he learned all of this from this journal of his grandfather, he's been fatalistic about it. He feels the guilt that his grandfather felt or should have felt, feels like he needs to pay this price. So he has just been like waiting for, once he knows that ghosts are on the way, he's not even prepared to resist it. He's ready to pay the price that he needs to pay. And the church gives us the location for that final, the few characters we know, or most of them are gathered in this one place and they're surrounded by bad guys and the ghosts are trying to break through the windows and attack everyone. And again, there's this weird back and forth. How physical are these ghosts? On the one hand, they have to break through windows. On the other hand, a little bit later, they just sort of appear in the church when Hal Holbrook goes out to confront them. Because another thing is, I'm not sure how this works, he finds the gold. It was melted down and formed into a giant gold cross that is there at the church. if all the gold is still there, I thought that they used the wealth from this guy who was trying to relocate the leper colony to build the town. Apparently they didn't spend it because they just turned it into a cross.
Two things. One, I don't know if it's possible that they used his collateral on a loan.
Oh, maybe.
Maybe. Two, I honestly got the impression that that was 1/6, that the father, that the grandfather, who felt guilty after doing so, took his 1/6 and melted it down and made this decoration for the church. Meanwhile, five other members of the town who did so used their portion, which was that big, to make this town happen. And so all he had was the one part he had remaining. He had the one part he was handed down to offer back, but that was all he had.
I like that. That never occurred to me. I don't know that they ever make that clear in the movie, but that is absolutely the explanation as far as I'm concerned, because it goes along with what we read in the journal about this kind of remorse that the elder Father Malone felt, that he took part in this conspiracy. In the end, he could not bear to actually spend the money on anything, so he essentially gave it to the church for safekeeping by melting it and turning it into this cross. And meanwhile, the other five conspirators each had their share, and they're the ones who spent it to build the town. That makes so much sense. I like that.
Yeah. And I don't think they spell that out, but that was so, especially with the tone of all the segments that are being read, it's what fit narratively in my head well. It just continued from there.
Great. I like that a lot. And Father Malone eventually, while they are trying to hide and defend themselves from the ghosts in the sacristy, Father Malone eventually discovers this cross, figures out what had happened, and struggles to carry it with him out into the church. And that's where the ghosts have simply appeared, led by Blake, who was the leader of this relocation effort.
And I will say, has a style that does not help us in terms of he stands there with a triangular hat and a saber. Dude is part of why it's easy to keep calling them pirates. Yes. The dude has a piratey style, but like people I knew in high school, they have the dress but don't work that field of work.
Yes.
So yeah.
All hat, no doubloons, huh?
Oh goodness, that's a
Yeah, that's probably why I keep thinking of them as stabby pirates. But, you know, he's there. He was 100 years ago, he was murdered by shipwreck. So I guess he decided to lean into it.
Oh, yeah. I you don't become that rich without understanding branding.
Right.
I know. Like, I'm nautical and I have creepy fog. Like, I either lean into this or this never gets off the ground.
And Rob Botten, who plays Blake, he is a special effects makeup creator. So it's one of these where the person who was working on the special effects and doing the ghost imagery and things for this movie, he embodied the chief ghost. I kind of like when that does, like when Tom Savini shows up as a monster in a movie that he's doing effects for. So Rob Botten did a lot of good movies. He worked on The Thing. He worked on RoboCop and Total Recall. He's done a lot of great work in movies. So it was kind of cool to see him as the lead. Again, I can't say bad guy necessarily, the lead ghost in this movie.
Yeah. He's not the bad guy. That's the weirdest thing. There's so many horror films where it's like there's the good guy where our heroes are being attacked by something evil and that makes them the good guys. Or they're being attacked by something natural, which makes them tragic, but the outside force is not is not something you can really put a hero or villain label on.
Yeah.
In The Fog, the ghosts are absolutely wronged, and wronged in a terrible and very graphic way. And while they are being very, very destructive and harsh and mean, it's hard to ever call them bad because there's so much sympathy.
Like a lot of good horror movies, it brings up these philosophical questions. Depends on how you feel about vengeance. Yeah. On the one hand, these ghosts are killing people who are individually innocent. That's wrong. Yes. That's wicked. That's evil.
That's wrong.
Those are evil actions. And yet, the movie at least establishes motivations for them. They are not motivated by pure hatred. They are not motivated by greed. They are motivated by a sense of justice. And that sense of justice gets warped over time by having been murdered by shipwreck 100 years ago. But you can't say that their motivations are purely evil, because it is in some way based upon an idea of justice. And it gets into, how do you feel about justice? Is a life for a life justice? Is, if they could find these six conspirators, would killing them have been justice? Is killing six apparently random people from the town justice? I would say no, absolutely not.
Probably not, yeah.
But at least it creates these questions and these threads and these things to think about. Because I don't think, apart from Father Malone, who, as you can imagine, becomes sort of willingly the sixth victim, the sixth sacrifice to these ghosts.
Yes.
He goes out, brings them the cross of gold that he has, and submits to being killed by Blake. Apart from him, I don't know that they ever establish in any way that the other people who are killed by the ghosts are related to the six conspirators.
You're right.
Would have made a little more sense
to me.
I don't
think they do. Yeah.
I mean, Adrienne Barbeau recently moved there from Chicago. I don't think she's related to anybody who was in Antonio Bay 100 years ago.
And when the ghosts go after her kid, that's definitely one of the moments where the ghosts are at their worst.
Yes.
Like, not justified.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the moment where our protagonists get to be the most heroic,
right?
In that saving. But yeah, that's an interesting thing as well to point out, that Father Malone is the only person who we've got a direct tie back, and he's the one who honestly goes up to them and gives back this gold and resigns himself to the fact that he must be there to, he must atone for the sins of his grandfather, and Blake will have his revenge.
Yeah. And he addresses Blake and sort of apologizes to him and says, I understand, I have your gold, and I must pay the price for what was done by my forebears.
And he hands them the gold, and the ghosts vanish.
The ghosts sort of vanish very spectacularly, in that Father Malone is holding this giant cross. The ghost of Blake reaches out and grabs it, and it is suddenly like flooded with some kind of spectral energy that appears to be killing Father Malone, and everything starts glowing, and the cross is either just glowing or becoming red hot. And it looks like this is going to be the spectacular way in which Father Malone is killed, but he's not. I think it's Nick comes in and grabs Father Malone away. And that's when the ghosts disappear. I think they might take the gold with them when they disappear.
I thought they did.
But the ghosts disappear, and Father Malone has been spared or saved in some way, which is a surprise. And you can start to wonder, well, did they get enough revenge and they really now just wanted the gold back because they didn't want the descendants of the people who killed them to have the gold? What's going on here? And we get the typical scenes towards the end of a horror movie where life can sort of slowly begin to get back to normal and people can start to process this weird trauma. But of course, there's a tag at the very end.
Yeah, Adrian's character gets to do the, like, you know, we're okay now. We'll rebuild. We'll learn our lesson, but the fog might come again.
Yes.
Be prepared. And then the tag at the end is honestly the point that it leaves you with the most powerfully, for good reason, because Malone's there kind of walking through. It's like, I'm alive.
Right. Why not six? Why didn't they take me?
There were only five. And he's looking where the ghost had been standing before, and it's empty. And this is where we see how the ghosts got into the room. As just in that little bit, before 1 o'clock strikes, the fog rolls in under the door, and suddenly the ghosts are back, and the sword swings, and Malone is decapitated, yes. And the movie ends.
Right. Just that instant before you see what the results of this decapitating swing. We go to black.
Yeah, and talk about cut to credits.
This is kind of Blake saying, oh, wait, I forgot something. It's kind of a Columbo
thing.
One more thing.
One more thing. Yeah. You said that there were going to be six deaths, but I only count five.
I think we're probably headed towards our final questions here.
You see, my wife, she's fascinated with nautical accidents. She's been reading a lot about them lately. Right.
She wants me to get a boat, but I don't know. That seems like so much work. There's the fog to deal with. But.
Exactly. But yes.
Yeah. So. Well, before we get to our final questions, please stay tuned for those. But in the meantime, if you want to support the Intermillennium Media Project, you can go to our shop at immproject.com and buy coffee mugs and t-shirts and all kinds of fun things like that. And if you want more of the Intermillennium Media Project, you can find all of our back episodes there at immproject.com or on your favorite podcast application. If you want to both support and get more of the IMMP, you can join our Patreon, where you will get lots of bonus audio content, and you will also have the ability to know that you are supporting the podcast. And if you join at the movie club level, you will get a mystery DVD in the mail periodically. Ooh. It'll creep in like the fog. Well, yes. Not really. It'll be brought by the U.S. Postal Service, but they're kind of creepy too.
No, they're fun. Yeah,
they're cool.
They're cool. But yeah, come join, see what it's like to be me, where random movies are presented to you and you get to see what you think.
And all of that are linked to our Patreon, a link to our Discord. We'd love to hear from you there. A link to our shop and a contact page where you can contact us by email or by U.S. mail with our P.O. box are all right there at immproject.com. And Ian, where can people find you?
I can be found online as Item Crafting on Blue Sky and on YouTube, as well as Item Crafting Live on Twitch, which I'm hoping to start streaming some stuff soon.
Great. And you can find me at bymatthewporter.com. And you can also find me on YouTube as bymatthewporter, where you will find things like the Draft House Diary movie and movie theater reviews. Recent reviews include Only Lovers Left Alive, a weird Jim Jarmusch vampire movie. Well, I guess it's time for final questions about The Fog. And it's a movie, so first question is screen or no screen?
I'm going to say screen. It was a good horror film. If you're looking for that kind of thing, this was good. It was not overly violent. It was violent in specific moments, but not, I wouldn't call it aggressively or egregiously.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was narratively significant.
Yeah, it's not a slasher movie. It's not violence after violence. It's not reveling in human beings doing terrible things to other human beings, which is the kind of horror movie I dislike.
Yeah.
It has violence that establishes stakes and gives you that heightened sense of tension that the movie's trying to build.
It's got a good creepy factor.
Yeah. So I also say screen. It's interesting. It was not the movie that I remembered. It wasn't, as I say, it wasn't as much of a mystery. There wasn't as much connecting the dots and figuring out the rules of how these ghosts operate, like you were saying, Ian, that was an interesting part of it. But even though it wasn't the movie I remembered, I enjoyed this viewing of it. And I would say that if you are a fan of spooky horror movies, this is a good one to watch.
Mm-hmm. Spooky horror is definitely the good description for this. Yeah. So it's a screen.
And then we've got our next question, which is revive, reboot, or rest in peace.
And this is one that, since I always check beforehand, this has a remake.
Right. I think it was 2005.
2005. Produced by John Carpenter.
Ah.
Directed by Rupert Wainwright. And it is the same story, but with small twists and a bit more going on. I have not seen it. It seems to be well-liked, and it was more financially successful upon release than the original Fog was, from what I understand. But it looks interesting. I'm not sure if I want to go see it, but if I'm looking for this again, maybe I'll try the 2005 one. But it's important to note that it has been made again, and there's an entire slightly deeper version. It's also good to note that it's based on a book, I think.
Oh, is it?
No. I'm trying to figure out. I got conflicting messages.
It was partly inspired by actual stories of shipwrecks and intentional shipwrecks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I take it that the concept has some relation to a book from the 75.
Ah.
But it doesn't follow any of the story. And so this is where some people say that it's connected and some people say it isn't.
Mm-hmm. And they mentioned Bodega Bay, which is the setting of Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, as a nearby town. That's kind of fun.
Yeah. Which the entire thing kind of sets itself in a world where a lot of this sort of stuff happens in general.
Right. It is a supernatural world.
Yeah. Okay. So it looks like it doesn't have any connection to the book other than title and some environmental similarities. Mm-hmm. Okay. But the fact that it could get, it makes those references and that it's connected like that is where I say I don't think it needs a reboot. And the only way I go for a revival in my mind is not to make it The Fog 2, but to make it something where The Fog is one of the multiple things that are canon in a story about something else in the horror and supernatural.
Oh, just take the tone and the sort of world that The Fog establishes, and there's some other story, some other ghosts out for revenge for some other reason.
Maybe it's me, having been raised by you, liking things like Twin Peaks and other stuff. The idea of someone trying to piece together supernatural things and the fog that rolled into town full of vengeful ghosts in this one place is one of the case reports of the sort of things this person is tracking down fits more as a continuation for me than just the fog's back and Blake's not happy anymore. Blake's still at it.
Interesting.
The fact that they set up rules that were specific enough gives the feeling that there's a layer of sense to be made for the wider world of this story, not just this one place and time.
If you wanted to tie it to the fog using characters who find themselves involved in something else, I guess the only characters you would have would be Adrian Barbeau's character, Stevie Wayne, the radio person, originally from Chicago, now in Antonio Bay. And you've also got Elizabeth and Nick, Jamie Lee Curtis and Tom Atkins characters.
Yes.
And we know that she is sort of on the road, just hitchhiking around. He has businesses in the town, but seems to have money that he could move around enough. Maybe they go out and explore something. I kind of want a bit of a combination here, because what comes to me is the journal that Father Malone found of his grandfather's was big. It was a large book. And he read the key pages about the founding of the town. But maybe there's more information about that journal. Maybe one of the people, maybe one of the other five conspirators didn't stay and help found Antonio Bay. Maybe he took his money and moved to Oregon or moved to Colorado or went somewhere else and spent his money to establish something else, some business, some mine, who knows what. And therefore, the ghosts aren't really done with their mission yet because something is still out there that has not been been avenged. So it could be some more information from the journal leads to another story.
We also don't have any answers to how Blake was rich.
I guess not.
His source of wealth was never established, but that's most important for we don't know anything about where the gold came from.
Oh.
Maybe the gold cross responded to Blake powerfully. Maybe that's less about Blake being a ghost and maybe something about this gold. For all you know, I'm going to take what you've got there and keep running with it. One of the five people who used their gold went off to somewhere else. Now there's this gold that for some reason, events that are connected to it can have that supernatural thing happen.
Hmm.
The gold that was stolen from him is part of what had the power to give Blake the connection to the fog and the everything else. And so now there's this tape sent by a radio station out in this town with this host on it, Stevie, being sent to this other town somewhere else with this gold, warning them about how dangerous the gold they've got there is, for all we know.
Oh, interesting.
There could be this interesting connection of kind of don't put it in the same place, don't keep it there, but use that as a way to tell a story somewhere else that ties back and might give new insight, but not repeat exactly the one we had.
And and you can establish more backstory with maybe Blake was not the otherwise innocent businessman who happened to be wealthy or gain his wealth in some honest means. And I like the structure you're suggesting because it allows for a gap in time. You could set this in 2024 with someone discovering this tape that somebody else thought was just crazy, this weird radio person in 1980 from California sent this thing and we filed it away. And meanwhile, someone is examining this old journal and connects the dots with this tape and starts to investigate.
Yeah.
And maybe this 21st century date is some significant anniversary for whatever was done with that share of the gold. Because that gives you a sequel without having to make it a 80s period piece. Not that I have anything against 80s period pieces, but the idea that something that had already waited 100 years for revenge can wait even longer now is fun.
They were celebrating the centennial of Antonio Bay. And this was released in 1980. So if you assume that that movie was exactly contemporary, we are 6 years away from 50 years out from that.
That's right. So the 150th anniversary of something.
Exactly. So who knows? You know, 6 years for Blake to sharpen that rapier and get called a pirate again. He pops up then. Who knows?
So I feel like I don't need a reboot, a remake.
Yeah.
But I'd be interested in a well-crafted, well-thought-out revival.
Yeah, I really do need to. I'm more and more thinking I need to see the 2005 film to be able to see what they did with it.
I haven't seen that either. Maybe we should watch that and we can make that a Patreon bonus sometime.
That could be excellent.
Yeah,
I'm completely with you. But it kind of, I just want the John Carpenter verse in some ways. But I don't need specifically this one to get this is a rest in peace, but. As this movie implied, rest in peace doesn't mean you won't be back. I will say this movie brought back flashbacks for me of my childhood in ways I didn't expect.
Oh, is that right?
And you're going to find it interesting.
How so?
Adrienne Barbeau, her voice immediately gave me flashbacks.
Yeah.
To a movie that is tonally similar to The Fog sometimes.
Hmm.
Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island, she plays one of the main characters. And so I'm also here thinking, I just don't want to go watch that again, because this was giving me some of those Scooby-Doo vibes in overall as well. And hearing her voice all throughout this film just kept reminding me. So I wanted to bring that up, that people my age might recognize some of the voices, some of the people playing characters in this, from other places more than you would expect.
I can't hear that without thinking about Stuart Lee's stand-up bit about Scooby-Doo and the pirate zombie jungle island.
Yes.
I'm going to have to drop a link to that in show notes. One of my favorite stand-up comedy bits of all time. But that's interesting. So Adrienne Barbeau sort of continued this connection with these spooky ghost stories.
Oh, yeah.
The way her presence can establish so much.
Yeah, she did a lot of stuff, but yeah, she plays Simon Lenore, one of the main characters from the place they come visit. So
that's cool. I didn't remember.
And
that.
It's another story where there's interesting things about the dead and the reason why they're coming back and revenge and everything else. So.
Oh, I hope she had a ton of fun doing things like that.
I hope so.
Well, I had a ton of fun watching this movie and talking with you about it.
I've had an excellent time getting to chat with you about it. Thank you.
But I think that wraps it up for this episode of the IMMP. We will be back in a couple of weeks with more tales of media from the 20th century.
And in the meantime, go find something new to watch.